This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's coming up on Africa News Tonight. We'll have a report on the Zimbabwe election aftermath. And French President Emmanuel Macron said today that France's ambassador to Niger is still in the country despite an ultimatum from the new army leaders to leave his post. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Observers, opposition parties, and civil society groups say Zimbabwe's national elections last week were marred by irregularities and intimidation of voters, leading to questions about the results. The National Electoral Commission announced over the weekend that incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa, the candidate of the ruling ZANU-PF party, has won a second five-year term. Reporter Guzaida Nawashi has more from Harare.
Civic society groups and most opposition political parties are calling the polls a sham. For the first time, voting in Zimbabwe took 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday last week, due to the administrative delays. This has been coupled with allegations of voter intimidation and rigging to favor the ruling ZANU-PF party. Late Saturday night, the Electoral Commission announced the presidential results, saying Mnangagwa won with roughly 54% of the vote. Now critics ponder the impact on a country that has been dealing with a battered economy, lingering international sanctions, and an unhappy population. Vivid Gwede is a political analyst.
People are genuinely depressed by what has just happened, and I think there is a little uncertainty about what it means for the future. Also, given that Zimbabwe was going to use this election to engage with the international community in terms of, re-engagement with the Commonwealth and dealing with this pariah status.
In Harare and most parts of the country, it's quiet. No jubilant celebrations by the winners, just an air of uncertainty. Analyst Rashid Mukundu says the feeling of despair is widespread.
There's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of fear about what the future holds for Zimbabwe. Many people are worried on this electoral outcome, but more so the short manner in which the rigging took place and the attempts to block many people from voting.
Mukundu adds that this will further worsen the economic situation in Zimbabwe.
So essentially we are looking at a deepening of the Zimbabwean social political crisis. We are looking at a continuation of the Zimbabwean crisis with very little hope for the ordinary person who still has to scrape the ground to put food on the table.
The main opposition, Citizens Coalition for Change, says it's preparing an appropriate response, claiming victory was snatched from it, which could lead to further isolation of Zimbabwe. Critics say the opposition's only recourse is to approach the courts, which rejected challenges to the 2018 elections with the same top two presidential candidates. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinawashe in Harare, Zimbabwe.
A coalition of opposition parties in Botswana wants regional bloc the Southern African Development Community, SADC, to call an emergency meeting to discuss Zimbabwe's disputed election. SADC's observer mission in its preliminary report indicated the election process fell short of local and international standards. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's opposition coalition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, called the Zimbabwe election a sham in a report submitted to SADC Executive Secretary Elias Makhosi. Ditapelo Gyarabetsi, leader of the opposition in parliament, says SADC must act to address concerns over the disputed poll.
We call on SADC to convene an emergency summit of heads of state and government to address the outcome of this discredited, shambolic election, which many commentators describe as the worst in the country's tortured history. In short, there were no elections in Zimbabwe.
Gyorapetsi says SADC should at least call for a rerun of the poll.
The summit should accordingly engage Zimbabwe civil society and all political actors for dialogue with a view to holding new elections which will conform to regional and international standards and the applicable laws of Zimbabwe, including its constitution and electoral laws.
Zimbabwe-based political analyst Effie Dlelancube applauds efforts to engage bodies like SADC over the poll dispute.
There must be no stone left unturned to find a resolution to the emerging political crisis born out of the disputed election. If it leads us to the cause, let us go there. If it is SADC, let us go there. If it is the African Union, let us go there.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission announced Sunday that President Emmerson Mnangagwa had won 52% of the vote, beating main opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. However, the opposition has since rejected the results after observers cited irregularities. But Mnangagwa told journalists in Harare Sunday he was happy he had won and that the process was free and fair. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Habroni, Botswana.
French President Emmanuel Macron said today that France's ambassador to Niger is still in the country, despite an ultimatum from the new army leaders to leave his post. According to the French news agency AFP, during a major foreign policy speech to ambassadors gathered in Paris, Macron confirmed that French envoy Sylviane Ité was listening from Niger capital Niamey. This despite being given a 48-hour deadline to leave the country last Friday. Niger's foreign ministry claimed that Ité refused to meet with the new rulers and cited French government actions contrary to the interests of Niger. Niger President Mohamed Bazoum was toppled on July 26 and has been detained along with his family at the presidential palace. While the Islamic State terror group continues to lose influence in Iraq, U.S. Major General Matthew W. McFarlane recently warned that Islamic State remnants still pose a threat to areas not under the protection of the U.S.-led coalition, including parts of Syria. Analysts see Islamic State expanding into Africa and Asia. For VOA, Dale Gavalak reports from Amman.
U.S. Major General Matthew W. McFarlane commands the Combined Joint Task Force, Operation Inherent Resolve, based in Iraq, working to defeat Islamic State militants and prevent their resurgence. In an online briefing to journalists this month, McFarlane called the group ISIS as well as the Arab acronym Daesh, said Islamic State no longer controls any territory, has lost leaders and fighters, and carries out fewer attacks than in the past. He said there was a 65% reduction in Islamic State activity this year compared to last year.
They continue to degrade. Having said that, there are still radical fighters out there that aspire to reemerge or rebuild the caliphate. We work very closely with our Iraqi counterparts. We share intelligence to make sure we address any possible reemergence or any possible threats that emerge from those ISIS fighters that are still at large. We also work to address the long-term efforts like repatriation of IDPs and Daesh detainees that are in the detention facilities in Syria.
Stephen Heidemann, a non-resident senior fellow at Washington's Brookings Institution, told VOA that McFarlane gave a fairly balanced assessment of Islamic State at this time. However, Heidemann points to a recent United Nations report that says the Islamic State group still commands between 5,000 and 7,000 fighters in Syria and Iraq.
There's certainly no sense we can declare mission accomplished in terms of Operation Inherent Resolve. It continues to play an important role in degrading ISIS, and yet ISIS retains the ability to sustain pretty high levels of insecurity in eastern Syria and northwestern Iraq. We can't underestimate the extent to which local groups that publicly affiliate with ISIS have in some ways overtaken the core group as a source of threat. Africa is clearly one arena in which we're seeing that happen.
A South Africa-based analyst, Martin Iwe, has also warned of the growing threat in Africa, where Islamic State is active in more than 20 countries already. He cautioned that the continent may represent the future of the caliphate. Analyst Nicholas Harris at Washington's New Lines Institute tells VOA that Islamic State is like a perennial, dormant in the Middle East heartland, but regenerating and springing to life in Central Asia and Africa.
ISIS has numerous cells in Syria and has also established in the sort of western badlands of Iraq a support network. ISIS has tried to manage the reality that it is a organization that's looking for this opportunity to spring back. The ISIS brand globally has found opportunity to grow in Central Asia, particularly Afghanistan, but also it's looking to spread into Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and is looking to try to take advantage of rising communal religious tensions in India.
Harris said that in Africa, Islamic State is trying to take advantage of the war in Sudan and the destabilization of Ethiopia. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces has laid out conditions for ending its conflict with the country's army. The RSF says it wants a peaceful solution and a return to civilian government. From Nairobi, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
In a statement, the leader of Sudan's Rapid Support Forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, said his group is ready to resolve the conflict with Sudan's armed forces peacefully, with a settlement that will lead to civilian rule. Dagalo says he wants talks that will include political parties and civil society, aim to restructure Sudan's national army and address the root causes of Sudan's wars. Hala Al-Karib is the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She suggests Dagalo's comments are at least partially for sure.
It's kind of trying to, to appeal to the international community, to the regional actors, and just to, they think that they can actually, wash their crimes and what they have done by just showing up and say that. But the grievances are way too much. And the level of violence that has been happening in Sudan, for the past, since April 15, it's historical.
She says the RSF and others involved in recent violence, abuse and atrocities must be punished for their crimes.
Without very serious compromises from the RSF sides, without, them accepting, responsibility of their crimes and accepting mechanisms of justice, and come clean about that, it's... Even if Burhan wanted to do that, even if an agreement was signed, that will be a recipe for another cycle of violence, in my view.
The RSF's vision to end the more than four-month conflict through a negotiated settlement comes as the leader of the Sovereign Council and Sudan's armed forces, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, visited the coastal city of Port Sudan Sunday, where he met government representatives and the United Nations officials and aid agencies who have set up a humanitarian base. Dr. Edgar Githua, a lecturer at USIU and Strathmore University, specializing in international relations, peace and conflict, told VOA the emergence of General al-Burhan in public is a sign of a man who is afraid of being sidelined in the country's future.
He's trying to also just gain acceptance and gain it's confidence building, not only to himself, but also to the international community. And I have a feeling this conflict in Sudan is coming to a point where he is beginning to realize that the longer it prolongs, the longer he will isolate himself internationally. So going forward, there will be overtures that will definitely try and bring about. He will be open to talks, discussions, negotiations towards de-escalating the whole situation in Sudan.
Conflict between Sudan's armed forces and rapid support forces broke out in April after the rival leaders failed to agree on how to lead the country to civilian rule. A power struggle ensued between al-Burhan and Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. The warring parties sent delegates to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, in an effort to reach an agreement, but the talks were unsuccessful. Githua says for talks to succeed, it will take some time.
Eventually, at some point, Burhan and Dagalo will have to come in front of the international community and cameras to shake hands and to bury the hatchet. But for now, if it's the representatives that are doing it, so be it. But I know Burhan will not want to meet with Dagalo anytime soon. He hates him and he considers him to be someone very junior and minor to him.
Al-Karib says her country needs a peaceful settlement that will stop the war and suffering.
I don't think the country can afford short-term solutions anymore. We have been on these cycles of short-term solutions for very, very long time and failed agreements. And every agreement fails. It takes us to an atrocity and violence that's worse than the one before.
The ongoing conflict has resulted in over 4.6 million people being forced from their homes. And the UN says that 6 million people are on the brink of famine. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Legislation recently proposed in Kenya's parliament would provide a framework for reducing carbon emissions by buying and selling carbon credits locally. Victoria Munga reports on one Kenya manufacturer who is making cook stoves designed to lower emissions.
Salome Kihara depended heavily on wood as her cooking fuel for years until she acquired this more efficient stove, popularly known as Kuni Okoa, meaning save the firewood in Swahili. The stoves are designed to burn wood efficiently, using less fuel, but are expensive for most Kenyans. Kihara said she was lucky to get it at a price almost 80% less than the usual cost. She says, I got it at about $7.50. I used to hear about how much it saves people money. She says, before then, I could not afford it because it was too expensive. So when I heard about the offer, I borrowed some money to buy it. The maker of the stove, Burn Manufacturing, is using carbon credits to help lower the cost, which can run up to $70 in Kenya. Carbon credits are permits that represent 1 ton of carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere. The permits can be earned by companies or individuals wishing to support the battle against climate change. Chris McKinney is the company's chief commercial officer.
And we can quantify quite exactly, okay, before homes had our stoves, here's how much wood or charcoal they were burning. And then after they have a burn stove, here's how much wood or charcoal they're using. And we find that that's a reduction, again, somewhere in the range of like 50 to 70% reduction in fuel being used. And that allows us to also calculate the reduction in CO2 that's emitted.
Burn Manufacturing gets its credit from Gold Standard Carbon Registry in Switzerland, one of several registries that confirm that a company is taking steps to reduce carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The credits can then be sold and monetized. Burn Manufacturing uses the carbon credits funding to subsidize the cost of the stoves. A 2022 UN Environmental Programme report on carbon emissions says that although solutions to transform society's ways of using energy exist, collective multilateral action is required. Kenya lawmakers are now debating a bill which could set rules for carbon credit trading. In Kenya, carbon credit financing and markets are currently operating, but with much legal uncertainty. Authorities and carbon traders believe the proposed bill will put the carbon markets on firmer ground and encourage more innovations like the low carbon-emitting stoves. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
A Kenyan innovator is recycling fish skin into leather clothes through a process known as fish skin tanning. As Juma Majanga reports from Kisumu, Kenya, Newton Owino's enterprise also aims to sustainably manage waste emanating from the fish filleting industries along the Lake Victoria coast.
It's sunrise in Kajulu village overlooking Lake Victoria and another busy day for Newton Owino. Growing up in the area, Owino saw the challenges posed by fish waste on the lake environment. Today, he recycles discarded fish skins, turning them into leather products like hats and shoes that are exported to fashion markets in the United States and Europe.
I came from a school of thought that environmental solutions can only be found locally. You don't need to solve it from outside. You can only look for a solution, local solutions to your problems. And therefore, I felt like I could develop business enterprises out of those problems.
The tanning process uses plant-based organic products that are sourced locally. Owino pays women, youth, and people living with disabilities to collect the fish skins before processing them and making the leather products. Maximila Achieng, a fish vendor in Kisumu, is among those impressed by Owino's idea. She says that before, the fish skin was useless. They could just dry the skin and use it as firewood because they didn't know what else to do with it. But now, she says, they use it to make products like shoes, belts, jackets, bags, and so on. Achieng's sentiments are echoed by shoemakers like Frederick Okuma. Seated in his shoemaking shop in Kisumu, Okuma says that leather from fish skin is really good. The leather makes for good quality shoes that customers prefer. According to local government officials, Kisumu hosts 9 fish filleting industries producing approximately 150,000 metric tons of fish waste annually, 80% being in the form of fish skin, which lets out a strong odor when decomposing and in high concentration can contaminate the water. Farida Salim is Kisumu County's Minister for Tourism, Trade and Industry.
We are looking at the material recovery centers where waste is separated and weighed and, you know, sold. The people who are bringing waste into the recovery centers are paid. It is the same thing we want to do with the fish waste. Now you know it's not waste, it's money.
Owino says his enterprise aims to sustainably manage waste emanating from the fish filleting industries along Lake Victoria.
Our business is anchored in protection of the 4 H's: animal health, plant health, environmental health, and human health.
It is also a profitable business, he says, and the demand is much higher than what he can produce. He is currently working on expanding production. With the increasing effects of climate change, populations are increasingly developing an environmental conscience, increasing the demand for such sustainable products like recycled fish leather. Juma Majanga of VOA News, Kisumu, Kenya.
And French media outlets RFI and France 24 have expressed incomprehension at the suspension of their operations in Gabon at the end of a fraught presidential election. According to the French news agency AFP, the government cut off the internet on Saturday evening and put a curfew in place, citing the risk of violence as voting drew to a close in the race between incumbent Ali Bongo Ondimba and his main opponent, Albert Ondo Ossa. Later that evening, the Communication Authority announced a provisional ban on the broadcasting in Gabon of France 24, RFI, and TV5 Monde. It accused them of a lack of objectivity and balance about the elections. In a statement yesterday, France Media Monde, the parent company of RFI and France 24, said it regrets and is surprised by this provisional suspension, which lacks foundation, adding that it deprives the Gabonese of two of their main sources of reliable and independent information. The elections in Gabon, presidential, legislative, and municipal, have gone ahead without the presence of the election observers. Paris-based media rights campaigners, Reports Without Borders, denounced the restrictions on foreign journalists covering the vote. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.